Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and John O'Bacon, episode 76 for July 4th, 2009, Inkscape.
This show is brought to you by listeners like you and your contributions. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks so much.
It's time for Floss Weekly, the show with free, libre, open-source software. That's what Floss stands for. I'm your host, Randall Schwartz. I know you're normally listening to Leo Laporte's dulcet tones right about now, but Leo is in China as you're listening to this and had to sort of, as we're taping this, sort of had to rush out of the studio and get his last-minute preparations for China. So I'm taking the helm for today's show, although I'm not completely steering all by myself. I have a fellow steerer. Is that a word, Jono? I don't know.
It is now.
Jono Bacon is with me today. Hello, Jono.
Hello, Randall. How are you doing?
Good to talk to you again. I'm having a great time. It's been wonderful. This is my first show that I've had to kind of do without Leo, so hopefully I'll be okay through it. It's a little fun, actually. I mean, Leo has a big chair to fill. No, wait, he's got a big ball to sim. No, I don't even want to go there. No.
let's just stay well clear of any of that, please. I mean, he's for once, he's gone, which means that we don't have any childish humor.
Oh, no, I'm pretty sure we'll be having the usual childish humor. It's not going to be so bad. You did a show with Leo last week, and I heard great things about that. Thanks for taking that role on for me while I was actually on site with a client. So appreciate that. Very nice. Thank you.
It was a lot of fun. I was a bit nervous. I didn't want to kind of, you know, steer your baby the wrong way. So I'm glad you liked it.
It was a great show. I listened to it the moment it was published, and I had a great time listening to it. So thank you for taking that on. Any other thing you want to say before we get to our guests?
No, I think we're about ready to roll.
Okay, great. So today's show, we have two of the key developers from the Inkscape project. John, you want to describe Inkscape for me?
So Inkscape is a vector graphics tool, and it started some time ago, and we'll hear from the guys about how it kicked off. But in recent years, it's become, I think, really the choice of for doing anything to do with vector graphics on particularly on the Linux desktop, but also on Windows as well. And it's a phenomenal project. I'm really, really excited that we can talk to the guys today about it.
Very good. So we have John Cruz, who's apparently been with the project since the beginning. We also have Ted Gould, also on the project from the beginning. John, where are you calling in from?
I'm down in Fullerton, California right now. And I've been for quite a while, so that's beautiful Southern California, just out of LA County.
Oh, really? I was just down there on a business trip. That's very nice. Very warm there, I remember. That's good for this time of year, I presume.
Oh, yes, definitely.
And, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, just not too hot. We definitely don't get the humidity like back east.
And we also have with us on today's show, we have Ted Gould. Ted, where are you calling in from?
North of Dallas in Sherman, Texas.
Woohoo, Texas. All right. Where things are bigger.
Everything's bigger.
So Ted, did you want to give us a quick rundown? I described Inkscape briefly in the opening, but could you give us kind of a short summary of what Inkscape is all about?
Inkscape is a vector graphics editor, similar to like Adobe Illustrator or CorelDRAW or Xar Extreme. And so it's designed for building graphics or mostly in the SVG format, which is a format done by the W3C. It's an XML-based format, and it's actually getting more and more popular on the web. It's been around for a long time, actually. I think since 2000, I think, was the first version of the spec, but it's actually starting to gain momentum. And in open source, it has a lot of momentum in icons and graphics because it's pretty much the only vector format that's being used in open source today.
You know, I just heard a bunch of acronyms there. So let's pull us apart just a little bit so I can I love how you did that you strung them all together just like a big long string. So this is a drawing program, but it's not a bit-oriented program. It's not like a painting program like, say, the GIMP or Photoshop, correct?
Correct. So it's a vector drawing program. So what that means is that we're actually keeping the mathematical representation of what the shapes are. So if you've got a rectangle, you'd keep the upper left-hand corner and the lower right-hand corner, and then you'd redraw it every time. So what would happen is that as you zoom in, it would get actually higher quality.
And the advantage of that is that rather than like in a paint program where once you lay it down, it's all pretty much done and it no longer has a logical representation that this pixel and that pixel relate to the same rectangle. By having it in drawing format, you can actually then say later on, change your mind to make it green instead of black or something.
Correct. And it also means that you could approach something on your computer, which is a relatively low resolution device, and say make a billboard out of it, which is you'd need a obviously higher resolution.
So this is similar to something like, say, Adobe Illustrator then?
Adobe Illustrator?
Yes.
Yes.
Similar. Okay. Exactly. Are there other programs that this is similar to?
CorelDRAW, Zarya Extreme. There's several. I mean, it also could take this kind of the role of a page layout for small layouts like brochures. Mm-hmm. So that'd be like a PageMaker or can't think of the big one. It's Quark.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. And you've been with the project from nearly the beginning.
Yeah, I was one of the founders of the Inkscape project. We started out with a project called SodiPodi, and we decided that we wanted to go in a different direction with the project. And so we took the SodiPodi code base and made Inkscape out of it.
What was SodiPodi?
So SodiPodi is a very similar program to Inkscape. It's a vector drawing program, and that's what it was done for several years. We just decided that we wanted to take the code base in a slightly different direction.
Okay, and so when you started this project and you saw that SodiPodi didn't do it for you, what was your motivation?
We had a bunch of patches that weren't actually being originally accepted by the maintainer of SodiPodi, mm-hmm. and we decided that we wanted to make a program with those patches and do some other changes that weren't going to be popular with the current leadership of the project.
Okay. So you basically forked the project then?
Yes.
And what was the original license of SodiPodi? And I presume
GPL.
So you're maintaining that in Inkscape then as well?
Correct.
How did you choose the name Inkscape?
So it was just a discussion on IRC. We kept talking about different things, the ideas of drawing and using ink, but then also the idea of a landscape, the idea that you can do anything you want to do. And the domain name was free, which is a key for any project today.
Helpful.
Yes, yep. Definitely. Picking names for projects is tough because you have to find the URLs to make that work, especially good URLs. Exactly. Hey, John.
Sorry. I was going to say, Ted, so people get involved in projects usually because it scratches some kind of itch. So what was the itch that this was scratching for you when you got involved in vector illustration hacking?
I don't know. For me, it's always – I've really thought that the vector was like the right answer. It's always seemed that bitmaps were a little bit of a hack and should be the final thing. And so I've always been interested in vector drawing. And actually, I was going to start my own project at some time, and then I found SodiPodi and I got involved there and I said, hey, this is really cool and I like the way it works. Us old Unix guys, remember when there wasn't anti-alias fonts on the desktop? And so just, adding that improvement has just been awesome.
Cool. Hey, so John, how did you get involved?
Well, I'd been keeping an eye on SodiPodi for a while, using it for work. I was doing research and development for devices, also to things Windows CE, some of the early Linux-based ones, all sorts of things like that. So SVG itself was really helpful, and vector graphics as a source format. So I treated it as the source code for our images for the interfaces we were going to put out, mm-hmm. and consider the bitmap version as the final compiled result. And I'd been trying to get into it, and it was just... The product or the software itself didn't quite do what I wanted, and I couldn't make it do what I wanted because of how it had been managed. So as soon as the fork from SodiPodi to the new project, yet to be unnamed, was announced, I was one of the ones who jumped right on and said, oh, yes, definitely. Great idea. It seems like you've done everything the right way. Seems like it's needed. Sure. And in fact, the first couple, I kept trying to contribute to both, and I think... the very first Inkscape change I put in was something about the color slider arrows not being visible, and I did a little tweak to fix that. Did some discussions with the SodiPodi maintainer about his concerns of the code being appropriate, and I tried to answer them, gave him some metrics. last time I checked, like a month ago, that bug patch is still sitting in the tracker there for SodiPoti this many years later. So it just then Inkscape let me contribute and let me join in right away and from the beginning and get going. And it's been a really good project that way.
So it's been scratching your itches then as well. And what was your, you said you had projects going on that Inkscape naturally fit?
Yeah, well, one of them is that I've been doing a lot of UI and design work as far as UI design and interface and graphics and handheld devices, set-top devices, all sorts of interesting things at different points, and then webmail. I've been bouncing back and forth on different things for a while, so I had that in mind. And then secondly, I was at a large company, and we knew our group was going to be shut down, so I was starting to look just in open source more in general. I'd been involved with Palfrey and a few others in the past, but I was trying to see is something that I can put a little more work into that I can actually show other companies when I go on interviews where I can't show, you know, XYZ Corporation's internal source code to somebody else who might want to hire me. I can show them open source. And so I can show design docs, discussions I've been involved with, source code, you know, all this. So as a software developer, just having an open resume and work pool to draw from and show potential employers was the primary immediate goal. And then the other thing is because I love multimedia and graphics, and I started out kind of straddling the line doing a little 3D animation before I settled into being better at programming. I like the graphical and ease of use for it. And also, it's pure. If you're going to deal with bitmap graphics, you have to understand a lot of the math, when to mesh layers, how you do things, and it's a lot more abstract, whereas vector graphics are the shapes themselves. So you're working really in an object-oriented representation of your artwork, which, so as a programmer who does art, that's also very attractive to me.
Sounds very good. You know, it's interesting. You're talking about how contributing to this project has given you code for your portfolio. I don't think we've ever actually addressed that before in Floss Weekly. That's actually a very good point. So has it actually come to fruition? I mean, do you actually take pieces of this code then as you're interviewing for new projects then?
I think I've shown one or two bits of code. There was, when I submitted some places, they asked for submitting samples of your code. And so I'll just grab a couple source files from Inkscape and send them on in. I've done that once or twice. Probably the most telling or most overt use I had for it was when I was interviewing for a job about 2 years ago. I started talking with the person, and it turns out the hiring director was involved in Perl and other things like that. So we started saying, you're this. So if I go into Subversion, am I going to see your name on all the source files and all this? And I was like, well, at that point, well, I haven't touched all the areas because there's a huge code base with all sorts of different areas someone can get involved in depending on what their interests are. But I was also able to say, however, I'm heavily involved in all the design discussions on the API. So all the extension API discussions that Ted's been having, you'll see my name in there. Look in our wiki for all the pages I've contributed to there for the high level, the Jabber chat room logs so that you can go back and see some of the interaction with other people. And so in that case, that was very beneficial for the employer because he knew open source, he knew what to see, and he could also tell when people were trying to just, you know, kind of inflate what they've done. And so having it there in open source, it's kind of you lay all your cards on the table. If you really are doing what you say you're doing, it's easy to see. And if you're not, it's also easy to see.
It sounds like part of the reason why you wanted to get involved in open source was to help you get a job, to prove your ability. So I think everyone's wondering, did you get a job? I mean, are you living out of a trash can, or did you manage to find a job and still able to work on Inkscape?
Well, at the moment, so far, the last few years, because it's been, I think, over 5.5 years now, I've actually gone through a few jobs. I know some people are in the same bands, but when you're working for a large corporation and they kill the West Coast development and lay off 700 engineers, you can't really take that too personally. The open source I've been working on, and having worked on Inkscape, has helped me land the jobs I did get. So contributing to open source has helped me get the proprietary jobs in proprietary software development.
It's very
interesting.
Cool.
And so in terms of getting involved, I mean, you're talking about people getting involved in Inkscape, and there's what you're saying is essentially you can transpose to any open source project. You know, if you work on open source code, you can show your abilities, you can prove yourself if you don't have a pre-existing reputation, all that kind of good stuff. Graphics seems to be very, very popular right now, and we're seeing vector graphics used throughout the desktop, throughout the Linux desktop, and we're seeing it in gaming and all kinds of stuff. So do you feel that Inkscape is a great learning ground? I mean, if somebody comes with a set of knowledge to get started, do you feel that they can learn the underlying graphics concepts of how to deal with vector graphics, the kind of stuff that you may even, you know, learn at university?
Yeah, I think it's really good. And also, that's why when I was looking to get more involved in open source, because I enjoy it and I've used a lot and I wanted to contribute. Graphically, I looked at the game, but that was a little too complex to get started with. If you ever tried to compile a GIMP plugin, it's really bad. But Inkscape, you can jump in there if you want to just use it to draw graphics and look at the XML that results out of it. That's an easy way to get an idea of the structure. If you want to write an extension, you can write an Inkscape extension in anything that does standard in and standard out. So we could Perl, Python, C++, Bash script, you can even write extensions on. So you can get going a lot quicker with just a little. And so that's like one of the beauties, I think, of the extensions API that Ted put in. It works. It's really low tech. It's nowhere near the final good thing that we want to have in that he's been planning on, but it is very sufficient and easy to get started with. We have people right. Come in all the time who get within a few days, they're doing something at least.
But it seems like graphics is a complex place to get started. So people may start cut their teeth on writing an extension, but you know, do you need to be some kind of crazy pixel pushing lunatic to be able to get involved in the project? What do people need to know if they want to get involved and participate in Inkscape?
Well, one of the things we have on our wiki is a page of how you can contribute to Inkscape without coding. So we have a lot of things. If someone just wants to be involved in a project, we've tried to break that down. We'll have a lot of issues we can bring up PR, bug fixing, tracking down stuff, even just some simple testing can really help. Then for coding, if you want to jump into the code, we have it, I think, decently documented. So if you jump on our Jabber or IRC chat room, ask for a little help, you can get guided to that aspect of the graphics that you want to know. But the really good thing is if once you understand vector graphics is vectors, you don't have to understand transform matrices and pixel alpha pre or post multiplication and all that. You just need to know, shape, path, points. Once you get to that level, you can get going and get something happening. So it's not that difficult. And in graphics in general, it's also a really easy learning bed. And then for some people, the right way to learn is through direct, since SVG is XML based, you can directly edit the XML in your favorite text editor to create things and try things out and see the results immediately. So if you're trying to learn how things work, transformations, even just simple things like that, you can play with the definitions directly in XML, which is fairly human readable, and see the visual results graphically right away. And that's a very helpful thing for someone trying to learn either to use graphics or to code them.
I guess what's cool about that as well, because it's text, because it's plain text, it means that people can, if you're learning, people can collaborate. So, you know, I could write a file and then send it to you and you could maybe edit it and fix some of my mistakes and then send me a diff and things like that. You know, the tools are there to encourage that kind of collaboration.
Yes, and that's really helpful. And if you have it cleaned up, there's, for example, someone put out a script over utilities, someone associated with SVG itself and the interest groups and working groups that will actually clean up a lot of the cruft that Inkscape puts in for editing. And once you have a cleaned up version, it's really easy to collaborate, really easy to show diffs and source control. And we also have a feature that probably needs a revamp to make it a little cleaner and work a little better, but it's an interactive whiteboard based on that same principle. Using exchanging over XMPP, you can both work on the same SVG file by throwing diffs across the wire back and forth.
That's pretty funky. And in terms of this, so, you know, a lot of us have heard about SVG and we've seen these funky little browser tests that people have been doing and all the cool stuff that you can do with it. Is it hard to understand? I mean, is it something that most of us mere mortals can get our pea-sized brains around?
Well, if you can grasp if you're looking at the low level, if you can grasp XML itself and, you know, the concept of tags, which most people who can wrangle a web page, they can get a decent idea, then the core functionality is pretty straightforward. You've got rectangles, some of them, and with Inkscape, often we use the element called path, which is, will allow for arbitrary shapes. We've added some special ones to make magic shapes, like the polygon path, which is the polygon or star tool. We add some of our own attributes to make it more editable, but, you know, once you look at them, it's not that hard to decipher what's going on. And so anyone who can understand the shape and know that a rectangle has to have 4 points, there you go. It's not that hard.
Great. Great. So, and we've talked a lot about this so far from the perspective of development, of people writing code. If you know, I don't know if I'm typical of a lot of people who use Inkscape or kind of high end drawing tools. But so what I tend to think to myself is, you know what, I'm going to play with Inkscape, and I install it. I grab it from the Ubuntu repositories, and then I load it, and then I look at all of the buttons, and then I cry for about 25 seconds, and then I close it again. And the same thing happens when I've loaded a Blender before. And I admit that I have the artistic talent of a rubber hammer, but there seems to be a very complex interface. And it may be easy within the realm of you know, comparative to Illustrator, something like that. But are you accepting people coming involved, getting involved, and in terms of improving the interface and UI testing and all that kind of good stuff?
Yes, we're definitely looking at the interface, how we can improve it. One of the things most people do like is it is a lot simpler than Illustrator and a bunch of others, but it's just as powerful. And we've had a lot of refinements, like having the single window with the tool palettes down the side and the others across the top. Those really help. And probably in general, the one thing, because I know that I've done the same thing myself. Now, Blender, from what I know, is the interface. The buttons and controls are really tricky, but once you learn the keyboard shortcuts, it starts to get a lot faster. Inkscape, on the other hand, as soon as you get the basic concepts of what's going on in the interface, it's a lot easier to use. And what we found, especially when people show up in our chat room, who just, same situation you are, just download it, open it up, trying to figure out what they need to do. They want to do something very simple. They don't know how, so they need to figure out. What we tell them is the secret is the help menu is actually helpful. If you go up and check under the help menu, we have one submenu with tutorials, which start with basic and move on the way up. And the really good thing about the tutorials is that they are actual live SVG documents themselves. So when you bring up like the basic tutorial, which describes all these tools, they show the tools in place in work, and you can click on any objects in the tutorial, and it is the live drawing interface, and you can see, oh, that's what that tool is, and that's what that button does, and move pretty quickly from there.
The other thing I like that we've done is we've used the status menu at the bottom to suggest additional keyboard commands. So a lot of times in drawing tools, you know, the control key restricts movement, and people know that, but how do you discover it? And so one of the things we've done is in the bottom, it's, you'll see it highlighted as, oh, you know, hey, hit control and you'll do this, or hit alt and I'll do this,
yeah.
Or tell you how many items you've got selected. I like to refer to it as an actually useful status menu.
I think that's cool. A really cool feature. It's something that when I was working on Jocosha, we stole outright from Inkscape. You know, it's a really intuitive means of learning the interface. But I mean, how much UI testing do you guys do with people? I mean, do you sit numpties like myself down to use Inkscape and watch what mistakes they make? Because is that something that you've done before?
I'm not aware of any formal UI testing. Are you, John?
Yeah, and yeah, I was going to say is that we've had a lot of ad hoc testing. One of the things is that some of our core developers, especially the engineer who's contributed the most code, is actually a graphic designer by trade. And so he uses Inkscape daily to produce art. And so we've got him, a couple others who are trained, who have their degree is in graphic design, and here they are coding on Inkscape.
So I think that's really what it comes down to is people are using the tool and developing something they want to use.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then personally, I've also been able to pull off some decent ad hoc UI testing at conventions because, for example, we'd show up at Scale Conference in Southern California every year. And that's been very beneficial because you get a good range there. You get some people who are hardcore Linux users, some who are casual, and then some who are business people who barely even know what a computer is, but they've been told Linux is the future. If you're going to make your business survive, you have to know it. So we get a good range of people walking through. So just sitting back and not saying much, doing the little usability testing things of just letting the person try it and not tell them how to use it, we pulled off there. And then moving forward a little more, I was just going to mention that we have a bit more plan to move forward on more formal usability testing. And probably one of the big things is that we're collaborating with a lot of other groups, a lot of other people. There's Peter Skilling who'd been helping the GIMP with their usability and UI design. We've met and talked with at the Libre Graphics meetings that have been occurring every year. And there's other groups, including a good usability team out of University of Waterloo that we've been talking with a little bit to see where can we bring this to open source a little better and bring in some new things. And one of the presentations that was made at the Libre Graphics meeting this year was on adaptive UIs, not modal, say, but ones that actually change the UI as you're trying to do a particular task. They reconfigure on the fly to give you task-appropriate interface. So, and we're close on the internals. We've gotten close to be able to do that. For the people involved, we want to do it, and then suddenly we've got a university team making a presentation about it in general that nails every point we've been thinking of. So they've got the research, they've got the more usability formal studies and all that. So we're really getting some good collaboration there.
It seems it would be really useful to take take Inkscape to maybe not so much of an open source conference, but to take it to a non-open source graphics place. Like I think one thing that would be really interesting as would be to have Adobe Illustrator people use it. I remember when I worked in my previous company, a guy who I worked with who was our designer was constantly complaining about the GIMP because he saw things from the perspective of a Photoshop person. And the transition was just impossible for him. And it seems such a shame when Inkscape's just a big, huge barrel of awesome. It's just incredible. And it seems like maybe that kind of thing will be really, really useful to do. But I don't know whether those opportunities exist for you guys to go and do that kind of thing.
It's hard, though, because if in the art community, you know, we always talk about an open source, how Microsoft has such a stranglehold. And I actually think Adobe really has more of a stranglehold on the market than Microsoft ever has. And I think it scares a lot of artists to try to use other tools. It really takes them out of their comfort zone. And so, I mean, we've gotten open source friendly artists who have used Illustrator as like, people have been hired at open source companies and stuff like that and gotten their feedback. But I couldn't imagine a setup where we could go to like an art school and actually, you know, it's almost unimaginable. Which is sad.
So Ted, what's your development platform? How are you cooperating amongst disparate people or distributed people to produce Inkscape?
What do you mean by a development platform? We use Linux mostly. I mean, most developers are Linux developers. We do have a couple of Win32 guys who manage the Win32 board and a couple OS X stuff. We're hosted at SourceForge.
SourceForge,
so means we're using SVN and we're using the Launchpad bug tracker because it's a lot better.
I understand you are a VI preferring person.
Oh, of course, yes.
Of course.
Crazy.
How about you, John?
Emacs, of course.
Emacs, there we go. We've got one of each. Good.
Yeah, and of course, I'm sitting here on Mac OS 10 right now, too. So, but and then my development environment is normally I'm working on my Mac OS 10 laptop, but I have remote SSHX into a Linux box in the back office. It's the kids' computer, but since they don't really use it that hard, I can do development on it at the same time.
I noticed the OS X port uses the X11 interface. Is there any thought of making a native Cocoa interface for this?
I don't think we'll do native Cocoa. There's a work on making porting GTK to the native OS X interface and using it through GTK. I don't think we'll ever rewrite the UI in Cocoa.
Okay.
That's a huge project. But the native GTK project's getting a lot better. So far as I know, it's somewhat usable if you're willing to take warts.
So let's talk about GTK for a few minutes. One thing that struck me is that GTK seems to be a project that's struggling, and this is has been expressed as, you know, as concern with various projects that depend on GTK. And then on the other hand, the Qt toolkit seems to have just all of this incredible graphics manipulation facilities included. What do you folks think about that?
Personally, I think there's a little bit of concern over GTK, but the big thing for us is the actual canvas, and the canvas is our own. So it doesn't really matter either way for us because we're just basically implementing the canvas by ourselves. But it would be interesting to use Qt's canvas, but that's about all we could really – that would be the big difference to us.
Yeah, and right. I've looked into Qt a few times professionally and personally, and I've worked with it. I've built products with it. For our needs for Inkscape, there's a few things it doesn't quite do. One of the things is it's a specific language, and it's their variant of C++, and that's it. We don't care so much that GTK can be any language, so that's not as much of a factor. But there is a bit of the, if you want to do something, use their class, that's it. And if what the toolkit does is what you want, it's really good. If it's not what you want, it's really tricky to work with. GTK is a bit more extensible that way. And for me, right now, the big killer thing, well, the licensing of Qt has been cleared up, so I think that's a non-issue now. That used to be the big one, and I'd have to warn companies about it where I worked. That was, oh yeah, you can use it, but these are the concerns. Those are gone now. But to me, there's a few things. Personally, the number one thing is tablet support. We've collaborated a lot with some of the Krita guys and others who do use it, and they're hitting all sorts of issues with tablets and also multiple displays. It just isn't quite handled so well, and it's you're given high-level access to it, but not low-level. And we want the low-level input events from the tablet so we can do the most with it. So for now, GTK on that front has a win.
So, Ted, I understand that Inkscape is still before version 1.0, still below version 1.0. What has to happen between now and 1.0 for you to call it 1.0?
We don't have any specific goals. There's a roadmap on the wiki, and I don't know how many people take that seriously. I think for 1.0, we've always tried to target when we actually fully implement the SVG spec. That's also a moving target, so I'm not entirely sure when we'll hit 1.0. It sounds good when we say that. I don't know that we have a specific plan, and I think most open source projects realize that version numbers are marketing.
Well, my theory is, though, that if you have if you don't have Inkscape 1.0, then the API might change as well. Is that going to be a problem, or are you pretty stable on the API?
Well, what's great about is we don't really have an API. Because so the only thing we're using to interface with, like, extensions and everything else, well, we use a little bit of XML, but mostly it's SVG itself. And mm-hmm. So basically it's a bug in Inkscape if we're not SVG compliant with the W3C standard. Okay. And so we were effectively void of the API issue because we don't actually do anything but what the W3C tells us. It's kind of a mixed bag because, right, you're a little bit restricted by that. But on the same side, where you don't have those arguments, like, what are we going to do? No, this is what it says. They've told us.
And I understand Google Summer of Code has been involved with your project in the past.
Yes, we've actually done Summer of Code every year, and we've had actually I think a 75% success rate overall, which is actually pretty high for Google Summer of Code. So,
what's the kind of things fantastic. That the kids have been able to contribute?
One of the big things was actually the inkboard support. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it. It's kind of gotten a little bit unstable as of late, but that was actually allows you to edit SVG documents over Jabber and actually do Jabber chat rooms, so you can have multiple people entering. And we've also done things like different optimizations for our rendering library. Currently, my student is working on actually an API over Dbus to be able to control Inkscape. So you can do like a scripting console for more precise work or for also making the extensions speed up. John, what have you guys done?
Well, let me see. The one I'm working with now is doing enhancements to color management, So for people doing pre-press and printing work, they might like to hear that, is that we've got a student actually doing the color management UI. The last couple of revisions, we put in the internals to support color profiling, soft proofing, all that, but now it's really going in for the UI. One of the other students this year is doing multiple node editing that will make that much nicer. And he's working under Bulia Bayek, who is probably the top code contributor right now. And he's also one of the top UI contributors we have, and who redesigned a lot of that.
And we also did all our PDF stuff, input and output, with Summer of Code, using Cairo and Poplar.
So you can read a PDF directly and edit it and hand it, write it back out?
Yeah.
Oh, very cool. Can you pull it all in at once, or just one page at a time, like creepy Illustrator?
One page at a time.
We don't have
multi-page support yet. Hopefully soon.
Oh, please. Oh, that would be so good, because I get PDF documents all the time that say, please sign this or edit that. And it's like, I just want to be able to pull it in. I've been using Illustrator to do that. But it's really annoying. It's like, I got to pull this all in. Crazy stuff. There's another overlap that you and I have, Ted. It's sort of interesting. I understand you've been funded from time to time by Linux Fund.
John's been working on that, so actually you'd be probably a better person to talk about it.
John, please.
Oh, yeah. So we've had, one of the things is our text tool, not the best. And we had someone come by a couple versions ago and who contributed a text setting toolbar that was a little bit better, but had its own problems. And since that's been one of the main feature areas that people who want to use it commercially or, you know, in a work environment have been requesting, Linux Fund came up and funded an individual to improve the text tool and text handling and the text interface for Inkscape. And we just saw a little more activity. The individual's doing some good progress on that. And I think the Linux Fund just put out a note that they had gotten matching funds for a lot of it. So it's kicked in a little more. Even if nothing else, it was really good, because once we heard that they were interested in funding someone, we put out the call, and then we had several people step up who were interested in doing it. So there was a little bit of a competition, and we got to find some good contributors for that, and new contributors too. So that's always good.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about Linux Fund, is that we get to give away money to worthwhile projects like yours, and it's been it's great that we can provide a little bit of the grease for the squeaky wheel for that as well. Very good. So is Inkscape being used? Lots of people, huge, small community, big community. Ted,
you know, it's hard. It's hard to say. You know, it's all open source, right? What's a metric? It seems that in general, in open source, it has really great traction. It seems like most of the people who do open source art for icon sets, for GNOME icon theme, they're using Inkscape. I'm actually really surprised at places I find it. There was a startup, and I can't think of their name now, but they were in the UK, and they were designing user interfaces using SVG, and they put all their user interface in there, and they actually, you know, created a dynamic user interface with it. And so I downloaded it, and I looked at it, and I'm like, oh, they're using SVG for this. And I open up the files, and it says created with Inkscape. I'm like, cool, you know. So you'd be surprised. It seems like that for a lot of small businesses that are open source friendly, they're also picking it up as their main graphics platform. So that's really exciting for us.
So the user community is much larger than the developer community for this thing. You'd say it's more of a retail product for most people then.
I would say so in general. And we have a pretty active users list. There's a good community on DeviantArt that's sitting and making really cool stuff with it. Actually, there's a gal who entered the Susan K. Coleman contest for breast cancer, and they had a contest on DeviantArt. And you can come with any tool. Anyone could come in and contribute to the contest. And she did her specific design in Inkscape, and she won.
Wow.
And I think that's pretty cool, just because it was a competition that could take any tool. I mean, you could use the most professional high-end tool you wanted. And, you know, I mean, it's obviously her talent that won it, but it's pretty cool to see our tool do that.
Now, the developers that are working on this are mostly working in what, C++?
Mostly C and C++.
And I understand you're unique in that you're one of the few C++ projects that uses the BWIM GC garbage collector.
Are we one of the only ones? I didn't realize that.
That's what I heard from somebody, so I just was just checking.
Yes, we do.
Good.
Yeah. And we have some interesting things come up with that, but from what I recall, we're the developer who put it in, researched it, and put it in some interesting ways, and it solves a lot of interesting problems. But then again, I think you hit just that, is that we're one of the few who are actually using it, so we don't have as many other people helping find the bugs for us. So a couple of the ones we find, we have to report. Although on my hand, I think I encountered one situation with the compiler where there was something weird going on, and that's it. So it's surprisingly robust for how few people are using it.
Now, how does so what it does is that is a garbage collecting layer on top. I mean, normally with C++, you have to alloc and free everything, you know, sort of directly. How does the BLUM GC help with that?
Well, I think the way we've been using it is the developer who put it in hooked in. By the way, that would also be mental guy, in case anyone wants to check details or follow up. But it made an abstract base class that implemented some of it and marked it. And so we have a base class that is collectible. And as long as everything is used correctly, the garbage collector gets to just go through and do its magic and clean up. Mm. We have some developer hooks to turn it off so that when you're trying to look for a certain type of leaks, you can find them. But because we're counting on garbage collection for lots of this, you get false hits on normal tools. And so I would say personally that if you are working in a language that has garbage collection natively, then you're going to get a little bit better support. But as long as you take care, this, to me, has seemed to be a bit better than some of the other solutions, especially some of the smart pointer implementations mm-hmm. and usage I've seen, where it's like, in general, smart pointers can be very helpful, but I've seen them used poorly too often.
Mm, okay.
Much as I'm right now quite exhilarated by the garbage collection discussion going on, it's something that I actually read about before I go to sleep at night. I have a quick question which I don't want to forget, and I'm an idiot, so I am going to forget it. So when I use the GIMP and I create something, maybe a kitten with a guitar as one such example, I can do all kinds of snazzy effects. I can, you know, I can have I can have lens flares. you know what I'm saying, I can have blur and motion blur and whatever kind of blur I want.
For the record, if you ever send me a photo, I'm not opening it.
You should have learned that lesson a long time ago, Ted. So, you know, I can do all of these amazing things in the GIMP and make it look really snazzy and cool and add all these subtle effects or not so subtle effects. But I don't seem to be able to do that with vectors. So, oh my goodness, I'm looking at the video now. Some kind of kitten with a guitar. Anyway, so I don't seem to be able to do that kind of stuff with Inkscape. Is that just not possible with vectors? Is that something you need bitmap kind of pixel stuff to do?
For the record, we did not plant this question. So new in 47 is where we actually kind of made the filters interface actually a lot more available. And what filters are is actually in part of the SVG standard where it takes the objects after they're rendered into a bitmap and applies bitmap type effects to those and puts them out on the display. So they're still vector objects, like you still have a rectangle, but after it gets rendered, these get applied. And so then you can do things like lens flares or there's a guy named Ivan who's done an amazing job. Like he commits like 3 times a day, all these new filters. And so I was joking that we should make a snow leopard video because now you can take some text, type in snow leopard, you go make it look like leopard skin and then put snow on top of it.
So I can have the same level of potential crack that I'd get in something like the GIMP.
I mean, they are different tools for different purposes. I think GIMP's optimized for certain things. I wouldn't say, you know, Inkscape you should use for all your photo editing. That's really not a rational thing to say. But we do have a lot of those effects now with the new filter support in 47. We always had them in 46, actually. They were actually another summer of code, but now it's actually easy to use.
Right. I haven't used Inkscape for a little while, but can I, can I interoperate between Inkscape and the GIMP? So can I save something and then feed, you know, can I create something in the GIMP, in Inkscape, feed it back into the GIMP, apply some filters, that kind of stuff? And
not really.
Do the two tools interoperate? Right.
We try to as much as possible.
Yeah, and I've hooked in a little bit recently where if you have a bitmap placed in your SVG, you can launch GIMP to edit that bitmap directly, and then you can also, when Inkscape comes back in focus, if you've saved changes to the bitmap on disk, it will reload them and bring them on in. And we're trying to increase that. We're definitely always talking with the GIMP people and others on how to best interoperate and share resources and share contents and clipboard and all that. And we're moving forward. And probably one of the best things, best presentations I've seen for that was the, one of the artists, Andy Fitzsimmons, did a good presentation on just how you flip back and forth, use all these tools together. And his main thing is he was going back and forth between GIMP and Inkscape like every 5 seconds between them. And it's starting to get there. We've got some hooks, but there's definitely more room for improvement.
Very cool. Very cool. Hey, just before we get going here, are you looking for more developers? And if so, what kind of skill levels are you looking for people that are not developers to contribute? And what kinds of skills would they require, Ted?
We always want people to contribute and get involved. There's different things to do, and I guess it depends on what your itch is and what you want to scratch. One of the things we tried to develop is an extension system that makes it easier to get involved. And what that is basically if you can write a program that takes in standard in and spits out standard out, then you can use whatever language or toolkit you like's XML library to change that SVG in some way. And that's all you basically need to write an extension for Inkscape. So you've got some idea, you know, I'd really like to draw 100 rectangles in a square, or, you know, I don't know what you want. You can get involved that way very quickly. And the story I like to tell is the of Aaron Spike, who started that way, and then he actually became a huge contributor. Because it's just kind of a good way to get a toehold. If you're interested in, you know, really hardcore stuff, we need that too. I'd really like to see long-term if we could redo our canvas and make it faster. I think that'd be a huge, huge boon to Inkscape, because right now I think the thing we're suffering from the most is just things like slow blur. Which makes Inkscape a little bit slower than most users would like. An exciting thing in 47 is that actually uses OpenMP now, so you get some multiprocessor support for it, but it's still not fast enough for most users.
Cool. So Ted Gould is one of the founding developers of the Inkscape project. John Cruz, also one of the founding developers of the Inkscape project. Thank you all for you being with us today and answering questions about Inkscape.
No problem. Thank you for having us.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Well, that was a great conversation with these guys. It's Inkscape, incredible. I mean, it's professional grade. I'm looking at some of the stuff that's being done with it and all that stuff. And you've had some experience with it, you said?
Yeah, I think limited experience is probably the most accurate way of describing it, because as I said in the interview, I'm not artistically gifted at all. I mean, I'm an abomination when it comes to anything visual. And so I've tried using it in the past, but I've been tracking the progress. I've always had like an interest in the graphics apps that we've seen, particularly on the Linux desktop, things like the GIMP, Blender, and Inkscape, and Describe, that kind of stuff. And the progress that they've made has just been just riveting. And I work for Canonical, and so I chat with them every so often about Inkscape, and you know, the work that those guys have done is just stunning. So big fan.
Yeah, and I'm a much better programmer than I am a drawer. I mean, I've got other people to take care of drawings and paintings and stuff for me. That's just not my area. I mean, I can kind of like put a little box together and highlight something. That's about it. I'm not area. It's a good thing I'm hired for programming and not for drawing.
Yeah. Everyone's got a graphics dude that they like lean on, you know? It's like when we did Look Radio, we'd like, oh, you know, we need to do a website. Well, yeah, should we talk to Mike? And there's this guy called Mike Evans who just basically does all of the graphics work. And he's our kind of pixel monkey, I think is the best way of describing it.
There you go. The guy that draws. The one designer you have to have around all the time, right? Of course, they're the ones that come to you and say, can you make this HTML do this and like that? So it all works out. It all evens out in the end.
It is. It's, yeah.
Jono, you've got a book coming out. Is it out yet? Is it getting close to being out?
Really close. I'm really excited. So Leo Laporte, who is, I don't know, he's in court today or something.
He's in China. Come on.
Nearly.
Maybe he's in court in China. We don't know.
So maybe he's in 24, you know, Mr. Bauer. So anyway, yes, the book's coming out soon. Leo sent me the foreword and it's fantastic. He's an incredible writer. So I'm assuming he probably got somebody else to write it for him. So in all seriousness, no, he's done a stunning job with the foreword. I got sent the first proof of, you know, it all, the QC1 with it all typeset and laid out. So I'm just about to go and read the entire thing again, just to double check that everything's hanging together. Okay. But yeah, it's looking great. I'm really, really proud of it. And it should be out on August the 21st.
And it's published by O'Reilly.
Our friends at O'Reilly. We love them.
You have a website for it as well.
Yeah, if you go to artofcommunityonline.org and you can find out about the book and the updates and all the rest of it. And people can pre-order it as well. I mean, the book will be available under a Creative Commons license as well, so people can download it and share it if they want. And that was really important at the start of the project to be able to do. But you can support the project and send a good message to O'Reilly by going out and pre-ordering and buying a copy. It's not too expensive as well. So
very cool. Out soon. That's very nice. And I haven't read it yet, but I probably should read it real soon. And speaking of things that I haven't done quite yet, we've got some upcoming shows for Floss Weekly that I wanted to give a quick pitch for. Next week, you'll have the show that, oh my God, it's you and me talking again. It's about Jaunty Jackalope. We taped the show a few weeks ago, but next week's show will be actually talking about Jaunty Jackalope and Ubuntu in general and some really great stuff on that show. So that'll be great. That's next week. 2 weeks from now, I just added to the schedule. This is going to be fun. Jono, you and I are going to be in studio for the taping of this on July 15th. And we're going to be fighting each other in a game of BZ Flag. That's Battlezone Flag. It's an open source thing that allows, it's basically Battlezone. And it's incredible. Servers are set up all over the world and people are playing games with each other online. And we'll both be in studio if you're going to watch the taping of that on July 15th. And so we've got Sean Morrison of the BZ Flag Project coming in on that one. And
I was going to say, the other thing that's great about that is that any game that allows tanks to bounce is a good thing in my mind.
BZ Flag is
bouncing tanks and Linux cranks or open source cranks. Yeah, that's what we should call it.
There we go. That's going to be a pretty crazy show. And then coming up after that, shortly after that, I've just been emailing with Eugene Sandulenko of the Scum VM, which is the virtual machine that can run all the old Lucasfilm games. And there's an open source version of that. And apparently there's been a little bit of a skirmish with Atari allowing versions of that to be embedded in stuff they're selling. And so we're actually going to get his side of the story on that, which should be pretty fun as well. And he'll talk about gaming and gaming platforms as well. So that'll be really fun. So that's just added to the schedule. We've got a bunch of people on the short list, probably Ganache coming up soon, maybe Coreboot coming up soon, maybe some MySQL coming up soon. You can always check out the current schedule coming up at twit.tv/floss. You can find my email address there if you want to suggest upcoming shows. But please check the current list before you see that, because you don't need to be redundant. If I already got it on the list, I've got 175 names on the list, so you don't need to send me anything that's already there. I've already got that.
You're like the open source dating agency.
I am. I have contacts for all these people. I just need to get them through. I mean, like I was telling Leo a couple weeks ago, we could do Floss Daily for about 6 months and we still wouldn't get caught up. So it's really great.
Randall Schwartz, the new social network.
My email address is on there, but you can also send email directly to me at floss@twit.tv. It's a little bit easier to remember than merlin@stonehenge.com, which is hard to spell. So there we go. You can also follow me on Twitter. I do a lot of karaoke live streaming. I'm doing that tonight, in fact. As we're taping anyway, twitter.com/merlin with a y, and we can follow you, John O'Bacon, at
twitter.com/John O'Bacon.
Just like a
check sounds. It out.
Very good, very good. So, John, you're almost a regular here. You're going to be on like the next couple, next three or four shows. I can take a break. I can go home.
It's great, and thanks again for letting me come on and ramble. I really appreciate it. And everybody in the IRC channel, I've been looking, and everyone's so very kind. So you'll see through the veil that I try to put out. At some point, you'll see who I really am. I'm just a vicious Englishman filled with cynicism. But thanks again.
Thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate that. And to all of our audience at home, without you, I wouldn't be doing a show. So thank you all for listening. And we'll see you again next time on Floss Weekly.